history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are some stories out there that need to be heard, and we're always better off for taking the time to listen. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And as we take that journey, we sure do learn a lot. We're educated, we're entertained, and so often inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. Today I'm in Santa Maria, California with 94-year-old Bob Metauer. And Bob, 94, are you sure? Because I heard you rode 6 miles on your bike this morning.
I was 94 on Tuesday, and my twin sister's the same age.
Funny how that works. And the riding 6 miles this morning, for a lot of 94-year-olds, that would be a big deal. For you, I guess that's nothing. How many miles have you ridden on your bike?
I'm over 94,750 miles.
When are you going to stop? Do you have a goal where you, once you reach it, you're going to quit the bike?
Well, I think good Lord is going to take care of that for me. I really haven't set a date.
Smart man, smart man. I'm sure the folks of Santa Maria have seen you on that bike a time or two around here, and I've even seen some TV clips of that. And if people are listening closely and they have that discerning ear, they might be able to tell you didn't grow up in Santa Maria, that there's a little East Coast to your accent. Where did this Bob Metauer story all begin?
Well, I was born 5 houses inside the New York City limits in a place called Queens Village in the front bedroom. I have a twin sister. We had a German midwife, and she went first, got all the looks and all the brains, and I came in second.
Well, it's going to be tough. I mean, it's radio, so the looks don't matter, but the brains probably do. So we'll hope that this suffices. So growing up in the New York City area during the Great Depression, what were those days like? What are some of the things you remember about your childhood there?
Well, we didn't have any money. You know, it was pretty tough. My father somehow managed to buy a house, and we had a nice house in Queens Village. What I remember most is that when I was 16 years old, I was going to Jamaica High School, and I was a butcher boy. And in those days, the people call up on the phone and ask for some meat, and I would deliver the meat. And I would ride as much as 50 miles on my back on Saturday. I did it all every afternoon and all day Saturday. And for that, I got $12. And I had to give the $12 to my mother because we had to eat. That's the way it was.
Well, and I think of New York during the 20s and 30s, and I think the Bronx Bombers. Were you a baseball fan at all?
Yes, I was. Dodgers and Yankees. Dodgers were there until 1957 when they moved out to L.A., and so were the Giants.
So did you ever get to go to any of those games?
Well, I told you I have 4 daughters, and it was very tough going. It took me a long time to earn enough to pay for all of the things. My family was spending money faster than I could make it. It took me a long time till I could get a few quarters to rub together. And I was able to see 1 Dodger game, 1 Yankee game, and 1 football Giant game.
I'm sure those were memorable occasions, and I think a lot of people were identifying with you when you talked about the money being spent before you made it. So you told me about being the butcher boy and delivering meat and all that, but before the war, before you got out of high school, did you have some ideas of what you wanted to do with your life or where you wanted to go, what kind of work you wanted to do?
No, I had none. It was tough to get a job. Nobody knew where the hell they were going to work. So it was tough to get a job.
What do you remember about December 7th, 1941?
Well, to be honest with you, I don't remember too much, other than the fact December 7th was my father's birthday. But I do remember, that the Japanese bombed, Honolulu and Pearl Harbor and all that. I don't even think it occurred to me that I would be going into the service.
So when did that change? How did you end up in the Navy?
Well, that changed when I got drafted. I graduated after my 18th birthday, so I was drafted, and I had to go to the draft board. And at that time, the Navy was taking a terrible pasting in the Pacific. And my mother said, "Don't you dare go in the Navy," when I was going to the draft board. So I went to the draft board, and they said, "Where do you want to go?" And I said, I want to go in the Army. He said, no, not today. Today you're in the Navy. One of the biggest breaks of my whole life.
But you didn't think so at the time, or just your mother didn't think so at the time?
Well, I don't remember my mother's reaction, but I was certainly happy.
But you had a few hiccups along the way. I understand you had a little issue in boot camp.
Well, that's true. I was in boot camp, and I went to breakfast, and when I finished eating, I tried to get up and couldn't even get up. I had to put my hand in my stomach to support it, and I went to sick bay. It turned out I had appendicitis. They did surgery on me and put me in the hospital, of course, and I was in bed for 7 days during the war. And then after that, I had a month of light duty. Turned out the appendix surgery was a good break for me, too. I wound up in the outgoing unit, and I got to know the first-class petty officer who was responsible for sending people out to different places, different schools and different ships and whatever. So I asked to be a radio man. He said, no, that's congressional appointment. Went down, kept going, and finally I wound up with machinist shop school, and he said, well, you can go there. So I went to Wentworth Institute up in Boston, and we're up there for 4 months. And we marched from the Somerset Hotel to Wentworth Institute, back and forth every day. After the 4 months were over, they sat us down. They said, where do you want to go? And I said, well, I'd like to go into a submarine. Well, I had had surgeries before the appendix, so I was not a candidate for the submarines. You have to be perfect. So my second choice was an aircraft carrier, and that's how I wound up on the Ticonderoga, the aircraft carrier.
And you mentioned a couple things there. You said it was a break that they weren't drafting into the Army the day you went to the draft board, and it was a break that your appendicitis happened when it did. So flesh that out for me. I'm sure you've thought about this a few times. What do you think the other scenarios would have been? Why was that a good break for you?
I have no idea. I have no idea what would have happened otherwise. But I wound up on the Ticonderoga, and I was a plaque owner, and we had to go down to Newport News, Virginia. And there we were loading the ship with supplies and so forth. Then we went on a shakedown cruise. And a shakedown cruise, the purpose of that is to have the crew learn how to maneuver and operate the ship and do all of the functions that has to be done. And at the same time, they launched some planes off the carrier, so the crew got that experience. After that, we came back and loaded up again. And then we went through the Panama Canal, and we went to San Diego, and there we loaded up again. We were in San Diego, and while we were there, we were off out in the ocean a little ways and launching planes. And one of the planes had some problems, and it ditched into the ocean. So back on land, they sent a PBY out to take a look at what happened to the crew, and the commander said, the weather's pretty rough out there, so don't land, just come back and report what you see. Well, when they went out there, they looked at the pilots were in a raft, and they saw that one of them was pretty badly injured, so they landed the plane and picked up the crew. When they got back to shore, the commander threw the pilot into the brig because he disobeyed orders. Well, Dixie Kiefer was the commander of the Ticonderoga. When he found out about that, he had a fit, and he went to that commander and said, you know, you get that young man out of the brig in a hurry. And that's what happened.
Because he disobeyed orders, but he probably saved that pilot's life by doing it.
Could be. After that, we loaded up the plane. The ship was filled up with planes and on flight deck and all of that. And then we were on our way to Pearl Harbor.
And a lot of people listening probably haven't been on an aircraft carrier, certainly not an Essex-class carrier from World War II. Was it a little eye-opening to get aboard that ship and see how massive it was and how a giant an operation it really was?
Well, it was the largest aircraft carrier in the world at that time. We had a crew of over 3,000 people, and yes, you know, it was amazing. And of course, you know, you're young, so you just go ahead and do what you have to do.
And everybody has a little different role among that 3,000-man crew. So what was yours? What were your duties on the ship?
Well, I started out in the hydraulic gang, and that was steering gear, anchor windlass, and the elevators that moved the plane from the hangar deck to the flight deck. And I was in the number one elevator pump room, which was way forward, way down in the bilge. And my job there was, when they blew flight quarters, my job was to go down into the pump room and push a button, wait till the pressure got high, open up a valve, and then call up topside and tell them we're ready to go. And they were kind enough to call me in when I talked to them. They said, well, come on up. So I ran all the way from the bilge all the way up to the flight deck, and on the starboard side, the controls for the forward elevator were on the side of the flight deck. And we stood in gratings, looked down through where you look through to the water. And that was how they operated with the buttons on the side of the elevator. The ship was loaded with planes, so they couldn't take off by themselves. So they had to be catapulted off. And when they catapulted the planes off, the wing would go right over our head as we were standing there.
I bet that's an experience nothing prepares you for.
No, that's right. It's quite exciting, really. And then they didn't just go, they didn't go right off. They dipped down and went down, and fortunately, there was 60 feet from the flight deck to the water. And they would probably go down to almost touch the water before they would have speed to go on up.
So you're aboard this ship, brand new ship. You just told us what your original role was. What about your first experience with what war's really like? Your first taste of an enemy to deal with?
Well, on January 21st in 1945... We had just finished bombing Saigon, so we're down there, and we were coming out to go back to another assignment. We were coming out, we're between the Philippines and Formosa, when we took two kamikazes. And my role there was, they blew general quarters, of course, and my role was to go to the forward mess hall. That was my battle station. And when we got there, the place was full of water up to your knees. And so the first thing we had to do was to get the hatch closed where the water was coming down from the flight deck. And having done that, then we were okay. And we were communicating with battle control. So battle control told us to get out of there and move to another compartment, which we did, and was dry there. And by this time, with smoke all over the place, the smoke was being brought in by the blowers that would normally air the place, and we had to put on our gas mask, and the lights were out, so that's where we were. And then battle control told us they lost contact with the compartment behind where we originally were, and asked us to go in there and see what was going on. So I think I was one of the first ones that went in, and there was a gentleman, was a chow hall. So this gentleman was sitting there with a pen light flashlight in his hand, and it was on. So I thought he was okay, and I went and picked up one of the other people and took him down to sick bay because they were overcome. They had no gas mask on. I went back into the compartment. That guy was still sitting there with the flashlight. So I said, you better get out of here, and he was out cold. So I took him to sick bay.
And when you say take him to sick bay, you had to carry him?
Yes. And then on the second trip, I heard his voice, and it was Eddie Mazur, my best friend. We both worked in the machine shop, and we made weights. He was a body specimen, and we made weights, and I had set aside an apartment up forward above the flight, the hangar deck. And when I blew general quarters, he was coming down a ladder when the first plane went through the flight deck and exploded in the hangar deck and made a piece of charcoal out of Eddie. It was terrible to see.
Well, as I was listening to you describe this, I'm thinking all of this was terrible to see. And what prepares you for that? I mean, you're a 20-year-old kid. Had you guys even experienced anything like this before? Had you seen other ships get hit by kamikazes? Did you know that threat was there?
No, I never saw it, but we knew the threat because we had heard about it.
In fact, 2 months earlier, the Ticonderoga's gun crews had shot down a would-be kamikaze that landed in the water just outside her starboard bow. That same day, another kamikaze from the same wave of attackers did strike the USS Lexington, killing 47 men. You can find photos of that January 21st, 1945 attack and the damage those two suicide planes did at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. And pretty soon, you're going to be able to see Bob's face on a banner above the streets of Santa Maria, California. It's not affiliated with this program, even though the name Hometown Heroes is the same, but the American Legion, VFW, and Parks and Recreation Department in Santa Maria have teamed up to honor local veterans in a very visible and fitting manner. Bob's banner will go up in January and remain on display until June, thanks to his neighbor, Jim Pate, who nominated him and also introduced him to me so we could introduce him to you today. When we come back, more about that day, January 21st, 1945, what a 20-year-old sailor experienced and how he helped others in need. 94-year-old Bob Mettauer of Santa Maria, California is our guest today, and we'll be right back after this. Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank, it's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Over 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 1,000 veterans now have gotten to see their memorial in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328.